Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and joining me now is New York Times Pentagon correspondent and former White House correspondent Helene Cooper, who is also a native of Liberia, whose family fled that country's civil war and moved to the U.S. when she was 13. And she's here today to talk about her new book, Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, also touch on some topics in the news as well as she continues to cover the Pentagon. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, became the first woman to lead an African nation when she became the 24th president of Liberia, an achievement Helene Cooper describes as a masterclass in how to get a woman elected president. Helene, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
A masterclass that a lot of people in the United States wish that somebody had taken.
Right? I mean, the whole time I was working on this book, I kept thinking that it would be coming out as the United States had its own first female elected president. And it turns out it wasn't. It was a little bit bittersweet for the people who supported Hillary Clinton.
And you do draw some parallels, and not to make too much of it because the people are different, the countries are very different, but some parallels with Clinton versus Trump.
The parallels are more because Hillary Clinton and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf are so similar when you think about it. They're both highly educated, overqualified global bureaucrats, and they were both running against men who had no political experience or government expertise or experience as well. In the case of Hillary Clinton, we had Donald Trump. And in the case of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, her opponent came ended up being George Weah, a professional football player. And so you have this professional football player running against a 67-year-old grandma who had worked at the IMF and World Bank and the United Nations and various treasury departments in Liberia under different governments. So it was like the experience gap was enormous.
In that case, grandma won.
In this case, grandma won. And grandma won because the Liberian women were fed up with the civil war. They had just come out of almost two decades of incomprehensible war. The wars in Liberia make the sort of wars that go on right now look like child's play. They are these nightmare scenarios where you have rebel soldiers wearing wedding gowns and blonde wigs and Halloween fright masks preying on the civilian population. So many women were raped. Children were kidnapped and drugged and forced to fight in the war. And during this entire time, the women of Liberia basically carried this country on their backs. They continued making markets, plowing the fields, having the children of their rapists in the forest, strapping those children on their backs, and then taking them back to the markets while they worked. And when they came out of this, they were so fed up with what they had been through that they sort of collectively determined that they needed a woman to lead the president, and they were going to do anything, they were going to do anything they conceivably could to make that happen.
This is 2005, we should say, right?
This was in 2005.
And to the point where do anything to get them elected. You mentioned her elected. You mentioned mothers stealing their sons' voting IDs so they couldn't vote.
Yeah, I talked to several women who did that. It was every year I've been surprised because a lot of people have asked me, well, doesn't that constitute voter fraud? I didn't think anybody in Liberia was thinking about along those lines. But there was one woman in particular I remember who referred to herself as the Oma, who snuck into her son's bedroom the night before election day and stole his wallet out of his pants pocket and buried his voter ID card in the yard. And she was completely unrepentant and unashamed about it.
We'll see if that becomes an issue in the Texas voter ID case. You know, mothers might steal these IDs.
You never know. But these women were outraged at the idea that their sons, who they had brought up through the war and sacrificed so much for, were then about to turn around and try, they, in their view, hand their country over to the football player.
So, listeners, I know we have Liberian Americans in our audience. If you want to call in and say anything or ask anything of Helene Cooper, her book, Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or anyone with a question for Helene as the current Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times, 212-433-9692. By the way, did I hear you emphasize the second syllable, sirleaf?
Sirleaf, yes. Liberian English is such an interesting sort of combination of both American Southern slang, a few Britishisms thrown in, and then Pidgin English, which we speak different varieties of in all different parts of West Africa. It's a great language because we speak in constant parable in Liberia. There's always a story behind almost everything that we're saying, and I was 13 when I moved here to the U.S., but it's something I've never lost.
People who may not know much about African politics or African heads of state may have heard of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, partly because she won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. What was that for?
She won for ushering the country out of the Civil War and restoring. I mean, she reached out to so many of her political opponents after she became president, and to great controversy, appointed some Charles Taylor, former government officials, into her government. And she was so terrified that if she didn't do this, the country would remain divided and you would have these people getting more and more angry. And so that, along with a lot of the advances she made on women's rights, and also just, I think a lot of the reason for the prize was because she stood because of her work in the past as a dissident under various administrations, but also
she'd been in jail, right?
Yeah, she was in jail. She was in jail for a year from 1985 to 86, which is in a lot of ways what sparked her drive and sparked the beginning of the women's movement in Liberia, especially from her point of view. She was in a cell the first night with this young 19-year-old Gio girl who had been gang raped by all these soldiers outside, and they brought her in bleeding and crying hysterically. And Ellen was sitting there next to her all night, you know, hugging her, holding her, and trying to comfort her. Mm. And in a lot of ways, going through that night with that girl sort of sparked the fire in Ellen to sort of try to get to the point where she could make sure nothing like this would happen again in Liberia.
So how much would you say she lived up to hopes or expectations as president of Liberia, first female African head of state? I know from your White House reporting, you can be tough on presidents who are elected with big hopes for being firsts.
Absolutely. And this is a great question. There were enormous amounts of hopes invested in her, particularly from women. And she's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. She's no Nelson Mandela. She's not a Robert Mugabe either. But there have been a lot of problems with her administration. Corruption in Liberia has remained prevalent in the Liberian government. She's had questions of nepotism with appointing her sons to high offices. And so there's a lot of nuance to this term. It's not a completely clean and pristine one. On the other hand, she's allowed freedoms, particularly freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of movement that we never had before in Liberia. People are and I can't say enough how huge that is. Anybody in the past growing up in Liberia, you got thrown into jail whenever you criticized the government. You listen to the Liberian radio stations now, and I mean, it's cacophonous, the amount of criticism that she gets, and she takes and takes and takes. And that, you know, that's a huge thing. And I think part of her legacy, because she's leaving at the end of this year, it's going to be that Liberians have become so used to the idea that they are free to say what they want, that they're not going to be willing to go back to a more repressive society.
That's a big deal.
That is a big deal.
Edson in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Helene Cooper. Hi, Edson.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show. My question is, I read her autobiography, The Coming of Age, The House of the Sugar Beet. Excellent biography. I recommend it. My question is, how much should blame the leaders in African countries, or should blame the Western for their politics towards Africa?
That's a Great question. I mean, I think everybody has shared culpability there. The European colonists that colonized most of Africa, not Liberia, because Liberia was colonized by freed American slaves, did a lot to wreck these civilizations and institute a very pervasive racist culture that still exists throughout Africa, where you have so many Africans today. I just did a story last year about women all over West Africa who bleached their skin, and that's partly because they believe, and this is coming down from the Europeans, that white is, you know, to be white, the whiter you are, the higher your class is going to be. At the same time, I think Africans have to take responsibility ourselves for the direction the continent has gone in. It's completely ridiculous that you have so many African strongmen leaders who refuse to step down. The fact that Robert Mugabe is still in office, you look in Cameroon at Paul Biya, you look go to Chad, to Idris Debbie, it's absurd. It gives lie to the meaning of democracy, and it's actually one thing that makes me end up feeling proud of Liberia and of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, that for the first time in Liberian history, you have a president who is not leaving because they put a bullet in her head or she died in office. At the end of this year, at the end of her second term, she's stepping down, and there are going to be elections in October and November for a new leader. And that's a big step.
Term limits, or is she being George Washington and saying, I will voluntarily leave, even though we've never set that precedent before?
Term limits. But she's abiding by them. Usually they extend the term limits.
There is that, yes. Okoji in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Okoji.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Sure. I have a question for Helen. Helen, and it might be more just a general question, but I might be a conspiracy theorist, but I just want you to speak to the fact that the United States CIA has been playing a very major role in Liberia, dating back to the tire company Firestone and putting Charles Taylor in power and also aiding the election of Sirleaf Johnson into that office.
You're raising a great point. I don't know that the CIA aided the – I don't think the CIA aided the election of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. I've seen nothing credible to suggest that. I have, however, seen plenty of credible evidence to suggest that the CIA helped get – not only contributed to the 1980 coup in Liberia that overthrew the Talbot regime, but they helped Charles Taylor bust out of a Massachusetts jail cell in a couple of years later and helped him when he moved then to Libya to train and was behind him at the – for a while when he invaded Liberia. So there's definitely a lot of that. You look at it's an extraordinary story on Charles Taylor getting out of jail that I explore in this book as well. But he was in a Plymouth, Massachusetts jail on charges that he stole from the Liberian government, and President Doe at the time was seeking his extradition. And somehow using a rope that he made out of bed sheets, he was able to escape out of a window of the jail, and there was a black getaway car waiting for him outside, and he was able to escape through leaving Massachusetts, going through New York, eventually ending up at the Mexican border and getting over the border and then flying to West Africa. So you put that in when you describe that, it's pretty hard not to believe that somebody was helping him.
Even conspiracy theories sometimes
yes, some
have grains of truth.
Theories, yeah.
My guest is Helene Cooper, New York Times Pentagon correspondent, who is also an immigrant to the United States from Liberia, coming when she was 13, and she's the author of a new book called Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And Greg in Montclair, you're on WNYC with Helene Cooper. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is actually in reference to your work as a Pentagon correspondent. I just read a really interesting article by Julia Yoffe in The Atlantic about the mood at the State Department being very morose under the Trump administration. And I was wondering, what is the mood like in the Pentagon? You know, it's obviously a very different situation there with the infusion of cash that Trump has promised and General Mattis and other generals being part of the administration. So if you could just talk to that, please, that'd be really interesting.
Sure, I'm happy to. You're right. It is very different at the Pentagon. But it's not only, I don't think it's primarily because of the infusion of cash, because a lot of people at the Pentagon are worried about the Trump administration proposed cuts in foreign aid and the State Department budget. General Mattis himself has said in the past that if you don't put money into foreign aid, you're going to have to buy me more guns, because we're going to have to use them more overseas in wars. And it seems almost as if President Trump has now taken him at his word. He's cutting foreign aid and giving the Pentagon more money. But the Pentagon is definitely, I think, more not isolated is the wrong word, more protected from kind of the craziness that you see coming out of Washington right now. Because for some reason, President Trump he adores Mr. Mattis, he's no longer an acting military general, who he only met after the election when he summoned him there to talk to him about the Secretary of Defense job. But he loves him, he pays attention to him. And Jim Mattis, at the moment, is in many ways viewed as the voice of sanity in this administration. I just spent a week and a half traveling with him in Europe. We're at NATO. We went to Munich to a security conference. Went to Iraq. We're in the Emirates. And everywhere he went, he spent his time reassuring American allies that, oh, don't worry, you know, Trump isn't going to do this. We're not going to pull out of NATO. We're not going to withdraw troops from Europe. We're not here in Iraq to steal anybody's oil. And he really, you know, he believes that, and he certainly has managed to pull Trump back from some of his more extreme impulses, particularly on things like torture. But at the same time, there's a question as to how long he can survive in this administration, given that he sort of is much more of a traditional Republican foreign policy thinker, and a very straight up guy who's not, if he sees things that he thinks are crazy, he's going to say so.
Does he knock heads, as far as your reporting can tell, with Steve Bannon or anybody in that respect?
I haven't been able to confirm. We've had a lot of allegations that there have been fights between the Bannon and the Mike Flynn wing and Mattis. I haven't been able to confirm that. And he has said point blank to us that he's getting along with people.
Do you understand the military buildup that the president wants? I mean, it seems like he'll build up the conventional military. And he was out the other day posing in front of, what was it, a battleship?
Aircraft carrier,
right. Building up the conventional military at a time when the threats are mainly from terrorist networks that require a whole different kind of response.
I do not understand the president's military buildup. I doubt if he understands his military buildup at this point, because we've seen very little specifics in the proposed Pentagon budget. He's talking about increasing the budget by $54 billion in fiscal 2018, but we haven't seen anything hard on where this money would come from. If you look at the military, they would love to have more battleships and they would love to have more airplanes. But Trump, at the same time, has complained about how much the F-35, fighter jet costs. So there's a lot of confusion about what exactly he wants, and there seems to be a lot of aspirational things in there that may not necessarily transcribe to real world
situations. In addition to that, his America First policy argues against big wars, which makes me again scratch my head about a big conventional military buildup.
There's a lot there to scratch your head about.
Is it part of, I don't know if this would be too much editorializing on your part, but is it part of Trump's nationalism, in your opinion, to be like a strong man who parades a big military? Could that be a reason for this?
I've not even thought about that. That's so interesting. It certainly would be in the tradition of the people he admires, like Vladimir Putin.
Exactly.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Francoise in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Helene Cooper. Hi, Francoise.
Hi, Brian. I'm calling to know what parallel can she draw between Ellen Johnson's service presidency and the one from Joyce Banda in Malawi, because she was she came to power, but eventually almost was plotted out. And I want to know what what your guest has, what opinion does your guest have in terms of parallel between that presidency and the one and Joyce's and Ellen Sirleaf president.
Comparing first female presidents.
Happy to. They're, the only thing Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Joyce Banda have in common is that they are women. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was elected democratically. Joyce Banda was appointed president. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is a global economic bureaucrat with a degree from Harvard who worked for the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF. She worked for various finance ministries, and she also is very deeply steeped in global economics. Joyce Banda was a market woman and who I think was not at all prepared to run a country. And for all the hoopla that greeted Joyce Banda being appointed and succeeding to the presidency, just keep remembering that she was not elected.
Louie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Helene Cooper. Hi, Louie.
Hi, Ms. Cooper. Wanted to laud you on your book, especially being highlighted today on Brian's show on Women's International Day.
This is the highlight of my book tour.
No, and I would imagine.
Must be a boring book tour.
I love your show. Help me process the following as
I'm kidding,
the
author
of the book who delved into her life and history, and as a Liberian. I rooted her on as a Latino gay man when the documentary came out produced by Abigail Disney, mm-hmm. when she got her Nobel Peace Prize and throughout her presidency. And one day I was watching CNN when she was interviewed sitting next to the former Prime Minister Tony Blair, and a Guardian reporter asked her about gay rights in Liberia. Mm-hmm. And she said this was the absolute antithesis of Liberian culture, and that no way, no how, and cut the reporter off. So how am I supposed to, as a Latino gay man and a feminist, support someone who denies my humanity?
That is an excellent question. And I think you, I don't think you necessarily should be expected to support somebody who denies your humanity. I will give you the sort of extenuating circumstances around that, but I'm not saying that, you know, what she says I think is enough right there for you to withdraw your support. Liberia is an extremely ostentatiously Christian country, even though 33% of the population is Muslim. It was founded by freed slaves who brought this big Southern Baptist type of mentality to Liberia, which the native Liberians then grasped onto. There are more churches in Liberia than there are schools. Beyond that, Africa, I think, is so far behind when it comes to gay rights. It's deplorable. They spend more time worrying about, you know, at a time where you see these countries which are wretchedly poor and struggling with health crises that would, you know, cripple anybody, and they're sitting around, you know, worrying about what people are doing in their bedrooms. It's ridiculous. And I think what Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was trying to do is to bat away a question in a political way that she knew would have relevance in. She was trying to protect herself politically in Liberia, and I don't defend that.
Louie, thank you for your call. We're just about out of time. The caller mentioned International Women's Day, which we're going to be talking about more after the news with one of your colleagues, actually, Susan Chira, who's gender editor for The Times. Is it a thing in Liberia? You know, one of the things that's come up is, oh, this day without a woman is really day without an American white upper middle class woman. Is International Women's Day a thing in Liberia, or if you know the region, other countries in the region?
It is a thing in Liberia, as much as they're having a colloquium there today, and there's some women, some high up women from around the world who can come and speak. But you will never find a day when those market women are not on the streets peddling their wares and selling their goods, because they have to survive.
Helene Cooper, New York Times Pentagon correspondent, is now the author of Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.